There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you are not one of them.
You want to
keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. This is Steve Falb. I'll be hosting this brief intro segment. This is podcast 344, May 2nd. 2009, and this is a special edition podcast with an interview with Tony Brooks. Nasser, please introduce this gentleman.
Thank you, sir. Tony Brooks, one of the legends of motor racing from the early part of the World Championship. Tony Brooks was a medical student when his passion for motor racing extracted him from being a dental surgeon. In fact, he carried his medical books to Syracuse, where he won the non-championship Syracuse Grand Prix. This made him the first British driver to win in a British car on the continent since Sir Henry Seagrave's victory in the San Sebastian Grand Prix of 1924. So there's a lot of history here. In 1958, he won the Belgian, German, and Italian Grand Prix, and these were all at classic tracks, you know, Spa, Nürburgring, the 14 mile, and Monza without the, you know, chicanes. And he was third in the World Championship. In 1959, he finished second in the championship. My sincere thanks to Mr. Tony Brooks for his time, Mrs. Brooks for hot tea, and Mr. Brazier for timely transportation. Without his help, you know, this would not have been possible. I also would like to thank Mr. Stuart Pringle of BRDC, who was kind enough to forward my request for interview to Mr. Brooks. So it was quite a global effort to make this.
Very team-oriented effort there to get that interview.
Yeah, I'm very thankful to all the people here, and I hope our listeners enjoy this conversation with Tony Brooks. Thank you.
And now, a moment in motorsport history, an interview with a racing legend.
Okay, I'm here in England with Tony Brooks, a British racing driver, British racing legend from the first decade of Grand Prix Formula One racing. Mr. Brooks, first of all, thank you so much. How are you today?
Well, thank you for the invitation to participate.
Before we talk about your great career, can we please get your thoughts on Britain's latest world champion, Lewis Hamilton, and the manner in which the 2008 championship was achieved on the last lap?
Well, he's obviously an outstanding driver, and you know, he was lucky to win his championship, and one can sympathise with Massa, who of course thought he'd won the championship, and I think the way he dealt with the post-race interviews was absolutely outstanding. He was really behaved like a gentleman and a champion in prospect. So Lewis Hamilton is absolutely outstanding, but it was a lucky win, and had it started to rain 2 minutes later, Massa would have won. And I think one has to bear in mind that Massa, in fact, was robbed of two races in the Hungarian Grand Prix. It was three laps from the finish when his car packed up. And then, of course, Ferrari messed up his pit stop in Singapore. So I've got a lot of empathy for Massa, not least because I finished second in the World Drivers' Championship in a Ferrari, so perhaps I'm a little bit lacking in objectivity there. But Hamilton is, you know, an outstanding driver, no question about it, and he was in arguably the best car of the year. But he made the most of it, but he also made quite a few mistakes, so he's going to have to cut down on those if he wants to be a consistent world champion.
Sounds like you follow Formula One regularly these days. Do you, if the race is out of Europe at an odd hour, would you get up to watch it live, or how do you follow these days?
Yes, I won't get up in the middle of the night to watch it, but I certainly watch it recorded on 3 o'clock, and if you don't hear the news, it doesn't make any difference, really. If you don't hear the news before the race is broadcast the second time. So, yes, I follow it, you know, fairly closely. an armchair observer, and occasionally go to Monaco, but I don't attend the Grand Prix normally.
Okay. In 1955, you took a historic win at Syracuse, first British win on the continent in over three decades. Please tell us how this deal with Connaught came about.
Well, I was invited by Connaught to go and drive the car in Syracuse, and I hadn't actually ever sat in a Formula One car until the day before the race, which was the Saturday, the race being on the Sunday, the 23rd of October, I think it was. And I was invited there because I'd done one or two races in an old Formula 2 Connaught, and obviously Connaught thought that I was a reasonably safe pair of hands, and gave me a chance. But I mean, in those days, October was after the end of the season, and I think there was a great shortage of suitable drivers, and I think in desperation, frankly, they chose me because I didn't really have a... Well, as I say, I hadn't even sat in a Formula One car, so I was very lucky that they had faith in me to give me that that opportunity.
I read that when you got there, they requested do not put on a lot of miles on the car because they were more concerned about the prize money, and you only did like 12, 13 laps before the race began?
Yes, that's right. Well, they had trouble getting the cars there in time because they had, first of all, trouble with their documents when they got to Calais, or was it Dunkirk? And they also had problem in those days. The motorways didn't, the autoroutes didn't go down the length of Italy, so they were in converted green line buses, and they had quite a difficulty going over the mountain passes and so on, which they had to do in those days, reversing backwards and forwards to get round the corners and that sort of thing. So they arrived late on the Saturday. Obviously, they should have been there on the Thursday at the latest. So, when they got there, of course. The important thing was to have the car start because the Connaughts were desperately short of money at the time, and it was the starting money which had attracted them to go to Syracuse. And literally, if you didn't start, you didn't get starting money. So the car didn't have a great reliability record, so that they didn't want me to do many laps in practice for fear of having any problems and not collecting their starting money.
And you rewarded them by winning the race at age 23. What is interesting, and I've read this many, many years ago and recently also, of course, that when you were flying to the race and coming back, you had your medical books getting ready for the exams. What was that like, and what was your plan at that time? Did you want to be a dental surgeon like your dad, or were you more interested in being a racing driver?
No, I qualified, because obviously racing driver, particularly in those days, was not... a very long career. I mean, in the 50s, there were an average three to four drivers killed a year every year. So it wasn't really a long-term, you know, business, really. I think Stirling saw it that way, but it was the record, the track record was poor. So I always intended to finish my dental degree, which I did in December 56. But I was studying for my... exams on the way out on the plane, on the way back on the plane, which is just as well because it prevented me thinking too much about what I'd said I'd go and do.
Yeah. And talking of traveling, you know, nowadays everything is done by a travel agent or PR people. How would drivers make arrangements to go to continental Europe, Morocco, South America?
Well, I think the team would make those arrangements normally, and depending on your arrangements, if if they were paying for your travel expenses, and they would arrange the trip for you. But maybe you have a deal whereby, you know, you pay for all expenses, hotels and everything, which goes to be down to you to make the arrangements.
Okay. You already addressed my next question, dangers in motor racing. Was there any... how did your family look at it, especially parents? Were they concerned about you trying to become a racing driver, or did they encourage you?
No, my parents were very enthusiastic, and they very much encouraged me. And my mother was very disappointed when I decided to give up racing. But I think really a question of ignorance being bliss, and that I think she thought I was infallible. Unfortunately, I wasn't, and nor was any other racing driver.
You were in the tragic 1955 Le Mans race. How do you remember that day, especially after what happened there with Pierre Levet?
Well, it was a very sad day indeed, to state the obvious. And, of course, it did bring motor racing to almost a halt in 55, because all the governments reacted very badly to that, because there were 80-plus spectators killed in that accident. And so motor racing got a very bad press, and a lot of people took fright. And in fact, the Swiss never ever held another motor race after that incident at Le Mans. So it was, a very sad day for most of all the driver and the spectators involved, but also for motor racing, because it gave it a very bad image, very bad record, and resulted in a lot of races being cancelled.
Your Formula One debut in 1956 at Silverstone was not very kind to you. What went through your mind when you realised the throttle was stuck at Abbey?
That wasn't my debut. My debut was, of course, Syracuse, although that wasn't a world championship event.
That's what I mean.
But my first world championship Grand Prix was at Silverstone, and the car was very quick in a straight line, but unfortunately it didn't handle. And if you went round a corner, other than geometrically, it didn't like it. And if anything untoward happened, it really, you couldn't do anything about it. And the accelerator stuck going into Abbey, having been repaired in the pits, because it broke. I mended it temporarily, got into the pits, lost about 7 laps whilst they were trying to fix it. And I'd been taking Abbey Curve flat, and whilst I'd been in the pits, obviously a little bit more oil and rubber had been put down. So when I went back on the circuit, I just needed a quick lift as opposed to going flat. And when I lifted my foot off the accelerator, it didn't respond, and the throttle was stuck open. And with a normal car, it would have been possible to run along the grass for perhaps 50 yards or so and edge back onto the circuit. But once you touch the grass with that car, that was completely out of your control. It would spin out of control and bounced across the circuit to the outside again, and turned itself over and did the only decent thing and set itself on fire. Because it was that sort of motor car, it needed to set itself on fire. But I was very lucky to get away with just a broken jaw and a chipped ankle bone.
In 1957, you made history again with Stirling Moss at Aintree, first all Britishman in a Formula One race. In those days, drivers could be called to give up. In this case, his car broke down. But how did you feel about being teammate to Moss? And I understand the team was leaning more towards him than you.
It was prearranged that he should take over my car, because I'd had an accident, my only other serious accident in my career, which was at Le Mans, and I'd been under an Aston Martin at Le Mans about 4 weeks or so beforehand, and I had tremendous abrasions and so on, and you could put a tennis ball into the hole that was in my hip. So I shouldn't have been allowed to race, but obviously you've got more chance of winning if you have 3 Van Wall start rather than 2, so I agreed to start. And in fact, I made second fastest time in practice to Moss, I think a couple of tenths of a second slower. But doing one fast practice lap and doing 90 laps in the condition I was, it just wasn't on. I mean, I shouldn't have been racing. And so it was arranged that if Stirling had some trouble with his car, I would bring my car in and he would take over. But he would never, ever take over my car in normal circumstances. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. You've just got to look at our respective times.
Yeah. Okay. But did you feel that the team was more interested in seeing Stirling Moss win? I've heard reports or read interviews, your interview, that you felt that you were not treated equally at Van Wall?
Yes, of course. Well, he was number one driver, and I signed on to number two, and I didn't like it. I shouldn't have signed the contract. So, yes, he had priority. He had, he had the choice of engine, choice of chassis, and so on. And he ensured that he had the best car as number one driver, which obviously is to my disadvantage. But I was in a very competitive team with virtually no track record, so I was counting myself lucky to be in the team. It was up to me to earn my stripes, as you might say, and you know, get equal rating, which of course I did when I went to Ferrari in 1959.
In 1958, your team, Van Wall, won the first Constructors' Cup. How did you find Tony Vanderwel as team owner? He was quite a character.
Yes, he was. I mean, he was. I always got on very, very well with Tony Vanderwel, and he was a dictator, which you had to be a successful team. You know, like Ferrari with Ferrari, Enzo Ferrari with Ferrari, and Tony Vanderwel with Van Wall. And I got on very well with Tony. I think we understood each other, and I think he had quite a lot of empathy for the fact that I tended to get what was left over after Stirling had picked his engine and his chassis. But as I say, I'm not complaining. That was the deal.
Another great character of British motor racing, Colin Chapman, worked for him. When he started his team, was there any opportunity or desire or invitation from Colin to join his team?
Yes, I was invited twice in 1960. And 61, I think. Anyway, 2 years. It might have been 59 and 60. But I very politely turned him down because his cars were very fast and he was a brilliant designer. But unfortunately, they had too many mechanical failures for my liking. And it was motor racing was quite dangerous enough at that time without having at the back of your mind that something might fail on the car. So very, very politely, I said, no, thank you.
The star driver was Jim Clark. Did you get to know him personally a little bit?
Not really, no. It was a little bit after me. I mean, we overlapped in 61, but I was driving a joke of a BRM again, you know, fancy driving twice for BRM. But I didn't see much of him, no. We were technically in the same races in 61, but he was in a competitive car and I was in an interim BRM with a second-hand Condrey Climax engine because they hadn't yet produced their own car. The BRM should have been available. The new BRM with the V8 engine should have been available at Monaco in 61. It actually appeared in practice only in Monza. So it was a great disappointment to me because the car, in fact, won the championship the following year. So I chose the right car, but I was 12 months too early.
Okay, in 1958, you won three classic Grand Prix in terms of tracks, Monza, Spa, and Nürburgring. Which track gave you the most satisfaction? Which victory, I'm sorry?
Well, I think I would, you know, put Spa and Nürburgring on a similar level because they were very different circuits, but both, you know, real driver circuits, real challenges. But you can't really, you know, compare one with the other. And but I think the greatest satisfaction I got was from winning the German Grand Prix because it was a very competitive race, and I had to pull back about, you know, 35 seconds on. Hawthorne and Mike Hawthorne and Peter Collins, having had a poor start in the race because the car was handling very badly with full petrol tanks. But as the tanks emptied, you know, the car started to handle much better. So to win a race at the Nürburgring was, you know, always a great thing. And to have the great battle with Peter and Mike, I think that gave me more satisfaction winning the German Grand Prix in 58 than Spa. But I got, you know, Spa in some ways, I got more of a thrill driving at Spa than at Nürburgring. But as I say, they're both tremendous driver circuits, but so different, you can't really say one's better than the other. And also it depends which car you're driving at the time as to which, you know, circuit you get the most pleasure from. But Spa gave me probably the greatest pleasure, but the German Grand Prix gave me more pleasure than the Belgian Grand Prix because it was a tremendous battle with Mike and Peter.
Peter Collins was killed in this race while trying to catch you. Yes. And he was your teammate in a race before. How do you remember him as a person and a driver?
Yes.
Competitor?
Yes, well, he's very nice, a very good-looking young chap, and of course chased after by the girls, and I always got on very well with Peter, and he was a very, very good driver. And of course, what happened to him took away the pleasure of the race. But when I won the race, I didn't know that it was other than, you know, just another accident, which of course we had only too frequently in the 50s. And I was not aware how serious it was until some hours after the race.
In the final race, Morocco, your teammate Stuart Lewis Evans was killed, and his manager was Bernie Ecclestone then. And you had a chance to win the championship. How disappointing was it that you were not able to win the championship, Drivers' Championship?
In 58, I had a chance for the championship. Yes, but of course, primarily we were trying to help Stirling to win the championship. Well, first of all, our prime objective, which we achieved, was to win the World Manufacturers' Championship. And then the second objective of the team was really to try and get Stirling to win the World Drivers' Championship. But I mean, given the situation with the cars, you know, and my being number two, my real opportunity to win the championship was in 59, when I, you know, had a car as good and no better than, you know, the other drivers in the team. So I finished third, I think it was, in 58, but yes, I wasn't many points behind, but I, as I say, the prime objective there was to beat Mike and to win the Manufacturers' Championship, which say we did.
Do you think Van Wall would have stayed in Grand Prix racing if Stuart Lewis Evans had not been killed?
Would they have continued, Van Wall, had Stuart Lewis Evans not been killed? We shall never know, but my guess is no, because, of course, it was we'd moved into the rear-engined era, and the front-engine cars were all, you know, were really having great difficulties dealing with the rear-engine cars in 58. And I think most people could see that 59 was going to be difficult for Van Wall to repeat its success against the Coopers and Lotuses. So I think Tony Van der Velde was probably sensible enough to realise that. And of course, it's great to quit when you're ahead. If you win the World Manufacturers' Championship and you think it's going to be very difficult to repeat that, it seems to me psychologically it's a sensible thing to quit.
Okay. You mentioned the 1959 season. You were a Ferrari driver. Did you experience the world-famous Ferrari politics at Ferrari?
No, I never had any problem with Enzo Ferrari. I really didn't. And we had an Anglo-American team anyway, because Behra fell out with Ferrari. He was a Frenchman, of course. And he left the team at Reims, the French Grand Prix. And so that left Phil Hill, Dan Gurney, Cliff Allison, myself, and we got on like a house on fire. Very competitive, but on, you know, a straightforward manner. You know, great camaraderie, and very competitive, but no nonsense.
You covered my next two questions. Jean Behra, you know, apparently reports say he punched Romolo Tavoni at Reims, the race he won, and Phil Hill was second in that race.
Yes.
And he recently passed away. Can you share some thoughts on these two gentlemen, your association and friendship with them, please?
Well, no, not really. I didn't speak French. I spoke Italian, and Behra didn't seem to. He spoke Italian. I wasn't aware that he did, and it must have been fairly basic. So apart from saying hello, how are you, bonjour, and so on, I didn't really have much to do with Jean Behra. And of course, Phil Hill was a super chap, and you know, a very good driver, and very simpatico, as we say, as the Italians say. And we kept in touch. I used to see them every year. Phil Hill and Dan Gurney, because we have a daughter in California, and we go over every year about Christmas time normally, not this year. And whenever we went over there, we would always have a dinner with Dan and Phil. So we very much kept in touch, and you know, he was a very warm person, and a great credit as to how he dealt with his illness. Really, absolutely an example to everybody. Top class chap.
Two more questions, please. In 1959 Sebring final race, again, you came very close to winning the championship, and you had an incident with your teammate, Vaughn Tripps. Can you talk us a little bit about that, and was that a big disappointment, winning out on the championship again?
Yes, it was, but in actual fact, I lost the championship earlier in the season, in as much as Ferrari didn't go to the British Grand Prix at Aintree because of a strike at the factory. And we'd been first and second in the Aintree 200 about 4 weeks or 5 weeks beforehand. So there should have been some points there, because I finished 4 points short of Jack Brabham at the end of the year, who won the championship. And then the Spa, the Belgian Grand Prix was cancelled, which would have been a Ferrari circuit, as opposed to the slow to medium speed circuits, which were more suited to the Lotus and Coopers. So Spa would have been a good chance for the Ferrari to win. I'd won every time I'd been to Spa, which is no guarantee, but we should have been in with a good chance there. And then at the Italian Grand Prix, I was a tenth of a second behind Sterling, who was on pole, and they challenged the clutch of the car overnight and either didn't bed it in or fit it properly, and I did about 100 metres. And Phil Hill finished second in that race, so again, one would reasonable to assume that we should have some points there. So then we came to Sebring, when we still had a chance of winning the championship, as did Stirling Moss and Jack Brabham. And I should have been on the front row with them, but Harry Schell was credited with a time he never did, because he missed out one of the corners, and he pushed me off my front row position across the grid to the second lap, second line, and which put me in front of Van Trips. And he was busy trying to convince Ferrari that he should be a regular Formula One driver. And I think that was his first drive in a Formula One Ferrari. I may be wrong, but he was intent on trying to say, look, I should be in the team. And, of course, what better way of convincing the Ferrari that he should be in the team would be to follow the team leader, as I was then, having on the basis of my results. And so he was intent on following the team leader, which he did, to the point where he shunted me up the rear on the first lap. And I came into the pits to check the car out, to make sure that that there was nothing, no serious damage to it. And I lost virtually a lap in coming into the pits, and I needed to finish first in that race. And in fact, I finished third, and finished second in the championship with just 4 points behind Jack Brabham. And we both won the same number of Grand Prix. And it was the one that got away. But every racing driver's got their hard luck story, but that's a longer one than average, I think.
A final question. Watkins Glen, 1961, first Grand Prix win for Team Lotus and final race for Tony Brooks, and with a podium finish. What were the main reasons for retiring from motor racing?
Well, there isn't a simple answer to this one, it's not a sort of it was this. It was a combination of things. I mean, first of all, I didn't have to continue with motor racing for as a career, because I had a perfectly good dental degree. The second thing was that I realised that one had to have a degree of luck to win the World Championship, which Stirling had proven pretty well. But what convinced me about the need for luck and the fact you could go on for a long time without winning the championship was in 1958, Stirling and I won 3 Grand Prix each for Van Wall. He won a fourth because he went to the Argentine with Rob Walker's Cooper. So he had 4 Grand Prix, I had 3 Grand Prix, and the world champion had 1. So I thought, well, you know, funny. And then in 1959, I've already explained, in 1959, you know, again, it could have happened, and it didn't happen. So I realised that, you needed a bit of luck on your side to win the Drivers' Championship. And the most important thing, which I should have put first, of course, is that I had married Pina and was starting a family. And as I said, I didn't have to motor race to earn a living. So, whereas most of the other racing drivers didn't have a good way of earning a living apart from motor racing. And so that wasn't a valid excuse for me continuing. The next reason was that I looked at my career and said, well, it's not bad, because I'd won 7 Grand Prix, 6 of them World Championship Grand Prix. In fact, I won 50% of the Grand Prix I finished between 55 and 59, those 5 years. And it wasn't a bad record, and a good gambler quits when he's ahead. And the other factor was that they'd gone to the Formula One, had become 1.5 litres 1961. And I mean, really, you know, to be able to get satisfaction out of driving and to show whether, in fact, you're better than the guy next door, you really need a car that has more power than the chassis can handle. And those cars were, you know, equivalent about 100cc go-kart. They were absolutely pathetic. So it's an amalgam of those things that made me think, and they'll say, essentially, a good gambler quits when he's ahead.
Finally, would you please give a message to our listeners?
Well, thank you very much for taking the trouble to listen to a very brief summary of my career. I hope to fill out a little bit more with my own personal biography in due course. I say my personal biography because most of them are written by others, but I've been convinced against my better judgment to, in fact, write the whole thing myself, because I've always written my own articles. So if you want to hear more about my career, there might be something you might be interested in the future.
We are very much, and I read about this, that you have very extensive notes, like Stirling Moss, maybe more. When is the book coming out, please?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've got to produce it, and, you know, I've got a lot of things that take me away from, you know, from beating out the keys on my laptop. So I don't want to be committed to a date. You know, I will produce it as soon as I can, and hopefully before I'm called to some other place. But so I'm totally refused to put a deadline on it, but I am beavering away, and I shall produce it in good time.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right.
Thank you, Tony Brooks, for joining F1Weekly.com, and thank you, listeners, for listening to this special edition of F1Weekly.com.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. Thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.